Hey guys, Mike back with you. One of the questions we're always asked is, hey, when is a review course going to come to my area? The best resource for you is to check flightbridgeed.com. Courses are being updated almost daily. If there's not one coming next to you, guess what? We've got the fully accredited online university where you can take courses from FlightBridgeEd, FoamFrat, and the list goes on. So check out FlightBridgeEd.com today for more information.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety.
Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today's podcast is a good lesson for all of us, and that is looking at a disease process that we don't often see a lot of, and that is asthmatics. Yes, I know we see asthma in different stages, and we have all treated asthma patients. We've treated COPD patients, but I think if I reflect on my career, to say that I've really had to work hard with an asthmatic patient where it's escalated to mechanical ventilation, I would say I could count on one hand. And so I think this is one of those types of calls, whether you're ground EMS, whether you're an ED nurse, or you're a flight crew, that can be stressful. These are very difficult to manage. There is definitely a way to handle these patients, and we can easily get mixed up by different factors that come before us. So this case study is a nightmare series case. This is a true case. I've changed a few things, but there are some valuable lessons that I think we all need to look at and remember. So let's dive in. You have an 18-year-old male patient. He's 5'5", so we calculate his ideal body weight at 60 kilos. He had an onset of asthma that was diagnosed after some bouts of shortness of breath. Just started having some shortness of breath at about 16 years old. Was diagnosed with eosinophilic asthma. Now, there's two subtypes of asthma. Eosinophilic is the worst. And then we have neutrophilic, and we will dive into that here in a bit. He started having symptoms based on this call after having some shortness of breath that was secondary to an upper respiratory infection that progressed into a severe cold. He tried to manage this at home per his girlfriend, took multiple NEBs. He's on corticosteroids with nothing helping. Eventually, he ends up coming into the ED based on his girlfriend driving him in. When he arrives, he has tachypneic. He has a respiratory rate of 28, heart rate of 134, blood pressure 103 over 69, and he is actually sating about 94%. They quickly work him up. They get an ABG. They start a nebulizer treatment on him, get IV access, and ABG results show a pH of 7.15, PaCO2 of 61, a bicarb of 24, and a base excess of negative 2. Now, we'll dive into those numbers, and we'll diagnose that here in a sec. I just want to highlight the case. ED physician does order a chest x-ray, shows hyperinflated lung fields bilaterally. He does have a flattened diaphragm. The patient progresses after multiple medications. He got albuterol times 3. He got Atrovent types 3. He was given MAG. He was given 3 doses of IM epi at 0.3. And eventually the patient starts getting fatigued, obtunded, and the physician decides to intubate. He chooses to intubate the patient with ketamine at 120 milligrams and rocuronium at 120 milligrams. He continuously sedates the patient with a 60 milligram dose of ketamine, and he gives a 100 mic dose of fentanyl. and then starts a ketamine drip at 1 mg/kg/hour. Patient is then prepared for transfer, and a receiving hospital accepts this patient. And so a flight crew is actually requested and arrives on scene. So before we get into the case further, let's dive into the actual pathophysiology. As I said, the patient was diagnosed 2 years ago with eosinophilic asthma. And we know eosinophils are part of our immune system and part of our white blood cells. And these specific white blood cells are going to respond to that allergen. And we know that when they do labs and they look at white blood cells and they look at the whole CBC, that oftentimes eosinophils will be elevated in really any allergic reaction. But specifically, when you get into those high levels of eosinophils, the more severe symptoms are going to be the highlight of these patients. And so I think it's important that when we look at eosinophilic asthma, understand this is a very rare type of asthma. Numbers show that really 5% or less of all adult patients have eosinophilic asthma. The majority, 95% or greater, have neutrophilic. When you look at this and you look at this patient specifically, really, he does not fit the mold. Number one, most patients that are diagnosed with eosinophilic asthma are usually in their late 20s, early 30s, or older. And he was diagnosed at 16. These patients have no past medical history of allergies, right? They don't have any other allergic responses to anything. We do know that based on research, these patients are very hard to treat. They don't respond to conventional treatments. They don't respond to standard corticosteroid doses. Even high doses seem to be poor. And when you look at the respiratory system, they have a systemic overall attack. So it's systemic. And the entire respiratory system is involved. When you compare eosinophilic asthma, not to get into the weeds, really, they classify this as a subtype. And that subtype is T2 high asthma. And to compare that, neutrophilic asthma would be a subtype of non-T2 asthma or T2 low asthma. So this patient has a confirmed diagnosis of eosinophilic asthma. This is very rare. We know going in, if you get this patient, and that is the diagnosis, that's always something to ask. And if family is there, you should get a proper response. And they should know what type of asthma these patients have. I think the thing to look at is that's going to give you some type of indicator that this patient is probably going to be difficult to treat. They're not going to be really responsive to conventional treatments. It's going to take a lot more to get them to turn around. So when we look at this case and we dissect this case, the first thing I want to dive into is remember, this is that obstructive lung pathophysiology. If we dissect his vitals, right, he's tachypneic when he comes in. He's got an end-tidal CO2 of 50. He's got an SpO2 of 94%, blood pressure 103 over 69, heart rate of 134. So the tachypnea is making the problem worse. We know these patients become very restricted. Airway caliber decreases. That makes it more difficult for them to take a breath. And so they easily become fatigued. Their respiratory effort is shallow and they become tight. And that is just going to cause them to have a higher respiratory rate. And we know that based on standard inspiratory-expiratory phase, we have a phase of inspiration and we have a phase of exhalation. And the faster we breathe, the shorter our E time becomes. So that is now causing a bigger problem. Not only is he becoming fatigued, airway resistance is increasing, airway caliber is decreasing. Now, every time he is trying to exhale, he takes another breath. And so now you start the cascade of air trapping and auto peep increases. When we look at the SpO2, 94%, you're probably saying, well, that's not that bad. And that's very, very true. Why is this patient sitting still appropriately? Well, remember, this is a ventilation failure in the very beginning stages. As this patient progresses and becomes more fatigued, he's going to have a difficult time with the inspiratory phase. And we're heading to that direction now, obviously. And that escalated to the point where he became fatigued enough that the physician decided to intubate the patient. That's where you're going to start having limited gas flow through the alveolar membrane, and your SpO2s will start dropping. And that is going to be a factor of simply not moving volume. So I think that is a big lesson that we're going to dive into further in this case, is we often classify these patients as a exhalation failure patient. But this is a twofold problem. And the first section of that is that inspiratory failure. Eventually, the inspiratory failure is just as big of a factor. What about the heart rate? Well, I'm sure he has a lot of anxiety. I'm sure he is very anxious and scared, and that is a factor that is causing that heart rate. End-tidal CO2 of 50. Obviously, anything greater than 45, we would classify that as hypercapnia. Does that alarm me? No, that doesn't alarm me. Patients are hypercapnic that are asthmatics. We know that the end-tidal CO2 is always going to be lower than the PaCO2, and our initial PaCO2 was 61. So you have a gradient there. That gradient's about 11 at this point. So when you walk in as a crew member and they give you that PaCO2 off that ABG, and as long as that is a very new number, you place them on a nasal cannula or they're already intubated and you're getting that waveform, that's going to give you a good idea based on that gradient of how to gauge your overall end-tidal CO2 and the changes you see within that patient. Now, if you have point-of-care testing, you have an ISTAT, you have an EPOC, you can make corrections with the vent and look at that and trend that in flight. So when we look at the ABG specifically, we have a pH of 7.15. We would call that uncompensated. We have a PaCO2 of 61. We know that that is hypercapnic. That's showing acidosis on the respiratory side. Bicarb of 24 is normal. Normal range is 22 to 26. And a base excess of -2 is normal. So we would simply classify this as uncompensated respiratory acidosis. When we look at treatment considerations, you know, this physician escalated from, you know, the patient having multiple dual nebs, had went aggressive with the epi, which I applaud him for, but BiPAP was never considered. So if you have this in your arsenal, and obviously we're in the COVID-19 era right now, and a lot of patients are not being placed on BiPAP because of the, you know, the whole aerosol situation, that may not be an avenue that you want to go down. But if you do have that ability, and we get out of this whole COVID-19 era, remember that BiPAP is a great, great way to attempt to augment these patients. And the whole theory of IPAP, EPAP in these patients, and why we wouldn't just go CPAP if we had the ability to go BiPAP, would be to be able to widen that gradient out. So the way I would approach this is I would probably start at, you know, 10, 12 on my IPAP, and I would place my EPAP low, 2 to 3. I want my gradient wide. I want a lower pressure EPAP during exhalation. I want a little bit higher IPAP because that's my ventilation side. And then I would gauge how the patient's doing, and I would try to titrate my vent for comfort. Obviously, this hospital didn't go that route, and this physician felt more comfortable based on what he and the team had to go to intubation. When we look at this patient from the standpoint of RSI medications, I thought the physician made good choices. Now, if he or she did not have ketamine as an RSI medication, that's fine. Etomidate would be appropriate, but we would probably go ketamine if you have that available. We know it has that beta 2 side to it. Rocuronium of 120 milligrams, great choice. Would sucks be wrong? No, wouldn't be wrong. Ketamine for sedation, we have a 60 milligram dose, and then he went a ketamine drip, and then fentanyl at 100 mics. So when we look at this, this patient, when you walk in as a flat crew, is being ventilated via bag valve mask ventilations and is just being transitioned over to the ventilator. The flight crew basically says, hey, why don't we just stop for a second? Let's get our vents set up. And why don't we just transition them to ours? The initial vent settings are these. They opted to go with pressure control ventilation. They started with an inspiratory pressure of 43. That gave them a PIP of 47 because they started with a PEEP of 5. So we have a inspiratory pressure of 43 over 5. That gives us a PIP of 47. That gives them an exhale tidal volume of 165. They set the respiratory rate of 14. They have an ID ratio of 1 to 4. And the rise time on this vent defaults at 4. They reassess vitals. Heart rate of 124, blood pressure now is 96 over 60, 93% SpO2, end tidal CO2 now is 66, and respiratory rate, as we said, is 14. What do you see wrong with those vent settings? Are those vent settings appropriate? I want you to ponder that. When we think about the patient that's 60 kilos ideal body weight, what should the target tidal volume be? Well, if we use the 6 to 8 mils per kilo, that target tidal volume should be 360 to 480. So that should be one of the first things that you think about is, hey, our exhale tidal volume is awfully low, 165 mils. And that is obviously going to cause the end tidal CO2 to increase. There's some other reasons why that end tidal CO2 could be as low as it is. I mean, we are generating an overall PIP of 47 to get that VTE of 165. What is going to be the correct way to deal with that? I want you to think about, is it appropriate to use a PIP of 5 on these patients? If you've read either of our books, the first book, Ventilator Management, A Pre-Hospital Perspective, I highlight a study that was done by Cleveland Clinic where they actually used the concept of narrowing and bringing up that PEEP to 75% of our auto PEEP. Well, remember, I've never given you an auto PEEP. We don't know what that is at this point. And essentially the thought process there is you're narrowing that critical opening pressure. You're bringing that driving pressure lower. But that is not always conventional and you don't always get buy-in from everybody. I've spoken to different physicians, RTs. Some agree, some don't. When we think about mechanical ventilation from that standpoint, it's very hard to teach just a standard way to manage these patients because we have multiple ventilators in our industry. A lot of you are using the Hamilton T1. Some of them are using the Revell. Others are still using LTV 1200s or the MV Plus. Some of you are using LTV 1000s. There are a lot of different ventilators out there, and I know a lot of nuances about each one, but to really say, hey, we have to change our rise time on this vent or we have to tweak it to this number, it's very hard. And so I'm going to speak based on different vents. The key here is to understand that this patient is only getting a VTE of 165. That is alarming. The other thing that may be uncomfortable to many of you is that PIP of 47. We always teach to keep that PIP, if at all possible, at 35 or lower. But we have to remember that these asthmatic patients, it may cause you, based on the airway resistance, based on the airway caliber, you may need to escalate to even drive enough pressure to get a tidal volume. And that is very, very normal. Based on those parameters, they decide to increase the ID ratio to 1 to 5 at this point. They're now seeing PIPs of 53, and they're still getting exhale tidal volumes that are critically low, now 147. About 5 minutes later, they reassess vitals. Now they have a heart rate of 103. They have a blood pressure of 86 over 60. SpO2 now is down to 87%, and end-tidal CO2 is 86. They decide at this point to regroup. They remove the patient from the ventilator. They allow for some exhalation, but very quickly put the patient back on the vent. So what is the problem here? Why is this patient continuing to decline? When you look back at this patient prior to being placed on the transport vent, the patient was being ventilated with a BVM and actually doing fairly well. So what is going on with these settings that's causing this patient to decline? So let's refocus our thought process. If we start from the beginning, the patient's problem, if we focus our care, he escalated to intubation because of fatigue. Why? Well, he was tachypneic. That translated to eventual muscle fatigue. That equals limited inspiratory volumes. That causes ensuing respiratory acidosis. That's secondary to limiting that gas movement, right? We don't have volume moving in through the alveolar capillary level, hypercapnia ensues. Because our respiratory rate is high, we end up having overinflation. We saw that with a chest x-ray, and that is classic for these COPD patients, obviously, and asthmatics. And why does that happen? Well, they have a poor ability to exhale. That's secondarily cascaded from that rapid rate, which causes a narrowing E-time, right? They're always spending the entire time inhaling. They never allow that full exhalation phase. So that air trapping starts. The next thing we start seeing in these patients is they have dead space ventilation. Why does that happen? Well, we have, again, limited gas movement. Gas movement is minimal. Nothing contributes to alveolar gas exchange. And as that illness progresses, that gets even worse. Now, how can you tell if this patient is getting to a point where they have limited inspiratory volumes? Well, we obviously use end-tidal CO2 waveforms, and we use that as a gauge for that ventilation side, and we use that as a way of assessing what number are they showing, right? We know that true respiratory failure is both an end-tidal CO2 greater than 50 and a PaO2 less than 60, but when you look at the ventilation side, the first thing we look at is that end-tidal over 50, which means that that PaCO2 has to be at least 51 or greater. So we're always gauging that end-tidal CO2. Well, we also know what a normal end-tidal CO2 looks like, and we know that we have that nice square waveform, might be slightly, you know, sloping upward, but when we start seeing a minimal end-tidal CO2 waveform, that is going to give you the indication that we are now not only in a ventilation failure, but we're also looking at inspiratory failure. We have limited inspiratory volumes, and it's this big cascading event. But I think the important part of this case is to remember that asthmatics, maybe severe COPD is aspiration, end up in both an inspiratory and expiratory failure. And we have to remember that. The key is obviously to get the patient to move air. If we get them to move air, you're gonna see that SpO2 improve. But I caution you not to focus on the SpO2. The SpO2 is most likely, in most cases, a factor of volume. Once we start fixing the volume moving in and out, the SpO2 should respond. We'll eventually see end-tidal CO2 waveforms go back to a normal size. Remember, when you see that shark fin appearance, that is an indication of poor alveolar emptying, but that small end-tidal CO2 waveform in that patient that is tachypneic and obtunded is an indication of that inspiratory failure. When we intubate these patients, and I know we're kind of going back to the beginning, and you escalate to that decision, you have to be thinking about the mechanical ventilation side. And that's the point of this podcast, is to understand that mechanical ventilation, if done correctly, not all these patients, obviously, are going to be easy, but there are some key areas that we should focus on. So I'm going to go through those key areas, and then we're going to come back to this case. Now, just for purposes of review, let's go back to where we left this patient. After the last reassessment, blood pressure was 86 over 60. SpO2 was down to 87%. End-tidal CO2 had climbed to 86. And heart rate was 103. Current vent settings, they have a total inspiratory pressure of 48. They have a PEEP of 5. That gives them an overall PIP of 53. Exhale tidal volumes are down to 147. And remember, based on this patient's ideal body weight, their target volume should be anywhere from 360 to 480. And a lot of times these patients do very well at 8 mils per kilo. So let's just say we're going to shoot for the 480 range. Because our end-tidal CO2 has increased from the last reassessment of 66 to now 86, they have opted to increase the respiratory rate. So remember, their initial respiratory rate was 14. And because their end-tidal is getting worse, they decide to increase their respiratory rate. And at the same time, they decide to lengthen their ID ratio to 1.5. And they have not changed or touched the eye time. So with that in mind, let's look at the mechanical ventilation side and some decisions that we have to consider. And the first decision we have to consider is, what is better? Should we go with volume or pressure? And I think the thing we have to first consider is what kind of ventilator you're using. If you're using the Hamilton T1, you know that you are always in a pressure delivery. There are volume targeted modes, meaning volume targeted, pressure regulated, but Hamilton does not have any true volume modes. It is always pressure, it's just targeting a volume. So always understand that. If you're using really any other vent, you have the option of going volume over pressure. So that's why we have to look at this from both sides. So volume, if we start there, what are the pros? Well, I think the pro is, number one, it guarantees your tidal volume. Whatever tidal volume you put in the vent, it's going to guarantee that. A negative to that is it could very well cause barotrauma. You could cause high plateau pressures, possibly. Oftentimes, these asthmatic patients are going to have a fairly high PIP and maybe a lower PPLAT. But once that alveolar pressure becomes distended and you have significant air trapping, auto PEEPs increase, that barotrauma potential is there. And that could easily lead to tension pneumothorax. When we go to the pressure side, one of the pros is obviously lung protection. That's one of the things that make us attracted to pressure control. A con, there's quite a few, honestly. You could have a pressure out situation. Well, what does that mean? Every ventilator has a maximum PIP it will go to. The Hamilton T1, for example, goes to 60 centimeters of water. Other vents go to 80 centimeters of water, but really you have to know your specific ventilator. And so you could have a patient that has a PIP that is, let's say that this is the Hamilton. What if you need to generate a higher overall PIP to get a breath? At some point, the ventilator is going to tap out. Well, let's use a Hamilton for example. We know that the upper pressure alarm limit is 60, and it will always terminate the breath 10 centimeters of water below our upper pressure limit level. So that means that you will pressure out at 50. A second con is if you do not understand your ventilator's rise time, and how that rise time affects the overall way the breath is delivered, this can cause a problem. Because ultimately, we have to understand we have a small airway caliber. And you really have set yourself up for problems based on the standard simple approach to that obstructive lung physiology, pathophysiology, I should say. And honestly, guys, I've taught this for years this way to keep it simple, but we're going to take this a step further. When we think about a rise time is essentially the length of time it takes to get there. So we can either get there, meaning the breath is either delivered rapidly, think about a steep ramp, or very slowly, a very gentle sloping ramp. And every ventilator is a little different. So if that rise time is set to a level that doesn't allow for enough time, because again, remember our airway caliber is small. And that means that we have to have enough time to generate a pressure that's going to give a overall volume in pressure control ventilation, right? Because that is compliance based, but we also have an airway that pressure has to pressurize, and that's going to elicit that volume. So if we don't have enough time, that's going to cause an issue. And as I started to allude to, one of the products of just standard simple teaching is, what have we always taught as our starting ID ratio in obstructive lung physiology and pathophysiology is that 1-to-4 ID ratio. Well, when you calculate a 1-to-4 ID ratio at a respiratory rate of 10, let's say for simple math, and that's what I've taught forever, right? And that teaching comes from Scott Weingart as well, is you think about obstructive lung patients, set the rate at 10 to 12 breaths per minute, tidal volume of 6 to 8. As I said, you can definitely go on the higher end. They seem to handle that fine. And set that ID ratio 1-to-4. So at a rate of 10, ID ratio 1-to-4, you're essentially giving a 1.2 second inspiratory phase and a 4.8 second expiratory phase. And that is the thought process. All right, well, I'm going to give 4 times the length of expiratory time than I am inspiratory time. But we have 2 factors. That rise time has to happen within that inspiratory phase. So we want to maximize that. If we start lengthening the ID ratio out even further, let's say we go to 1-to-5 like this crew did, what happens to that I time? It gets shorter. E time gets longer. So now we have less of a time period to inflate that lung. So this is where we have to look at and think about, is this patient specifically, once we get to a late stage, are they an expiratory failure only? Or could you say that this is now a very troublesome inspiratory failure as well? And that we have to consider both phases of our respiratory cycle. So this is where I want you to rethink what you've learned in the past. I've really been thinking about this case for quite some time, contemplating and trying to wrap my head around some of these things, and it makes perfect sense now. When you have a patient that is in this state, they're this tight, airway caliber is small, you have to consider them both an inspiratory and expiratory failure, and you have to protect both sides. So how do we do that? We're still going to set the rate at 10. So tidal volumes are going to be 6 to 8 mils per kilo. Again, don't be afraid to go 8 mils per kilo, respiratory rate of 10, make it simple. Whether you go volume or pressure, I laid out the pros and cons. This is not a podcast that's guiding you either way. I think the pros and cons speak for themselves. And honestly, the ventilator that you use is going to guide some of that thought process. But what if we changed up the ID ratio, and instead of going a 1-to-4, What if we went to 1-to-1? Well, what does that look like? As I said, if you went a 1-to-4 ID ratio with a rate of 10, you're going to have a 1.2 second inspiratory time and a 4.8 second expiratory time. And the way I got that is we know we have 10 breaths per minute. We divide that into that 60 second time frame and we get 6 seconds. So we have a 6 second respiratory cycle time, 10 times per minute. And I'm just splitting that ratio up. So we have 6 seconds, and during that 6 seconds, we have to have the inspiratory phase and an expiratory phase, and we have a 1-to-4 ratio. So that's where we get a 1.2 second inspiratory phase, 4.8 second expiratory phase. Now let's change that and think of that from a 1-to-1 ID ratio. Well, that's simple math. We still have a 6 second respiratory cycle time, but if we go 1-to-1, now all of a sudden we have a 3 second inspiratory phase and a 3 second expiratory phase. And man, what a difference that makes. Because again, it is just as much about an inspiratory failure as it is an expiratory failure. So what's the best approach? Number one, tidal volume of 6 to 8 mils per kilo based on ideal body weight, volume or pressure based on your preference, based on your ventilator capacity or capabilities. Rate 10 to 12. I will probably go more at 10. ID ratio. You know, what I would say is start at 1-to-2, go down to 1-to-1, but it really makes a lot of sense to me now that a 1-to-1 ID ratio in this type of patient probably is the best option. What about your ramp or rise time? Every ventilator is a little different. Hamilton T1 has a very massive range for ramp. The Revell, the LTVs, the MV, a much more narrow range. Some of the ventilators, LTVs, MVs, Revell, there's no way to physically turn off the rise time. When you're in pressure control ventilation, the rise time is active. You have to change that variable based on what you want. And in these patients, you probably need to have a rise time that's going to give you a little bit more time. With that said, remember every patient is a little different. You may have to play with it. You may have to adjust it a few times. The Hamilton actually allows you to turn the ramp off. And I think that that is definitely a way to go, is just take that variable out in some cases. Turn it off. Don't make it part of the equation. Don't forget to continue with your pharmacology. Give good sedation. Paralyze these patients. These patients do not need to trigger the vent. They do not need to contribute. Evaluate the auto PEEP if you have that capability. If you notice that your exhale tidal volumes are low, if they started off adequate and are much lower, remember this patient could be suffering from severe air trapping and auto PEEP, and you could have a situation where you have an impending hemodynamic collapse. And so take them off the vent, place your hands in their axilla, and gently kind of push in and help them exhale. So based on that, let's go back to this patient. When we evaluate their settings, again, we have a total PIP of 53, exhale tidal volume of 147, respiratory rate 28, ID ratio is now 1-to-5, rise time of 4, and PEEP of 5. So why do you think they raised the rate? Well, this is a product of early teaching. It's a product of standard ALS teaching. Whether you're a nurse or paramedic, we're taught simple. And I was talking this weekend to some colleagues up in Minnesota. And when we're stressed, when we have stressful situations, we often go back to the basics. We go back to the things that we can recall quickly. And we were always taught, if your patient is hypercapnic, if they're not breathing adequately, what do? Well, they're retaining CO2, so you increase the rate. If a patient is hypocapnic, if they're blowing off too much CO2, what are we taught? Oh, well, they're breathing too fast. Let's slow it down. And we know in critical care, that is not the truth. We can't go off of that. And in a patient like this, that is a catastrophic mistake. Because again, we already have an ID ratio 1:5. Respiratory rate now is 28. And so you are doing a very poor job. You think you're doing the right thing, right? Go back to your basics. But what you've done is you've really limited that inspiratory phase. And you already have a very narrow caliber airway, a very high PIP, and you're not getting any tidal volume from that. So here's the key. This patient needs to have some major adjustments. Here's what I would do. I would target that tidal volume of 480. I would turn my rate down to 10. Whatever PIP I get, right? Let's just shoot right now for a PIP of 45. I turn my PEEP off all the way. At this point, I'm turning my PEEP off. I may turn my rise time up if I have that ability. I may turn it completely off if I have that capability. And I'm changing my ID ratio to 1:1. When you consider simple changes, this patient then progresses to a exhaled tidal volume of 430 mils within about 10 minutes. So the crew finally made some realizations, and they changed just a couple things. They dropped that rate. They changed the ID ratio to 1:1. Remember, that gives you a 3-second inspiratory phase, 3-second expiratory phase. They turn the PEEP all the way off. At that point, reassessment, 10 minutes later, they have a heart rate of 103. They have a blood pressure of 93/62. SpO2 is slowly coming up. We're right around 90%. End tidal CO2 is 80. So we're heading the right direction. The thing I want you to really, really remember is hypercapnia is not going to kill your patient. Very, very, very rarely is that a factor. What's going to kill your patient is that inability to move gas, that huge amount of air trapping auto PEEP that's going to decrease your patient's ability to generate cardiac output, right? You're going to be in a hemodynamic collapse situation. That ultimately is what is going to kill your patient. So hypercapnia, it's been shown in ARDS, Amato and his colleagues in that study where they looked at driving pressure is a great example. Yeah, not the same type of patient, but it's still a patient that became very hypercapnic where they decided, hey, we're going to allow this patient's CO2 to climb greater than 100 in some cases, in a lot of cases. And they dropped their tidal volume down to 3 mL/kg to decrease driving pressure. And once that lung healed, once that lung responded, they slowly increased that minute ventilation by increasing tidal volume and allowed that CO2 to drop. And patients did very well. Don't get so focused in on the end tidal CO2. It is a factor of what's going on. But you can see based on this case, it will drive you to make the wrong choice almost every time. And I talk about this in the context of the 3 Ps of end tidal CO2 in that partially compensated metabolic acidosis. We do the same exact thing in that case. You walk in, you see somebody that's hyperventilating, they're breathing Kussmaul respirations, let's say DKA patient, and we think that they are just breathing too fast, and you try to drop that rate, or you intubate them and you don't recognize that this is a compensatory mechanism, and they're doing that to assist the buffering systems, right? Carbonic is maxed out, respiratory system has to kick in. Kidneys are also maxed out, and that respiratory side has to kick in, grab onto all the hydrogen it can, grab onto the bicarb, combine those together, make carbonic acid, which we know splits off into CO2 and water. CO2 can be exhaled, water is evaporated. It's the same thing. But we're taught, we go back to the basics. Hey, we have a hyperventilating patient, they're breathing too fast, they're blowing off the CO2, we gotta get them to slow down. And that is the wrong choice. So you have to look at the big picture in these cases. You have to look at why is that happening? And then understand that these patients, this patient specifically, is a very, very difficult, complex patient. And it really is easy to make the wrong choice. Don't forget your pharmacology. Don't forget other medications. Don't forget to continue with standard NEBS through the vent circuit. Consider other meds like tributaline. Think about EpiDrips. Lots of different things you can consider. But really, I think where we as a critical care transport team, whether you're ground, whether you're HEMS, that mechanical ventilator is a big, big problem if we mismanage it. So I hope this was enlightening. I hope this shed some light on some areas that were maybe fuzzy. Hopefully I taught you something new. If you have any cases, if you have any ideas, anything that is an area that you see as a need, please reach out to me, eric.bauer@flyverjet.com, and I will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.
Flight Bridge Ed is a proud media sponsor of Medevac Foundation International, a nonprofit organization that takes pride in taking care of our own in the medical transport community. Every dollar raised supports taking care of our own, help is on the way. This programming provides tools to combat depression and PTSD in our EMS community. The annual Run to Help the Helpers event is happening now. It's a virtual run, walk, or roll. That means cycle, rollerblade, skate, scooter, or wheelchair for EMS wellness and suicide prevention. As long as you're self-powered from start to finish, you can run to help the helpers any way you want, anytime you want, anywhere you want, or for as far as you want. Sign up today at medevacfoundation.org/events and tell them help is on the way.